Welcome to the show, and thank you so much for listening. This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens, with 75 absorbable vitamins and minerals in just one scoop per day. I've increased my energy, immune function, and so much more. AG is a non-negotiable part of my daily routine. For your own risk-free AG, plus 20% off, and free vitamin D3 K2 supplement, go to www.athleticgreens.com/functionally autoimmune, or look in the notes of this podcast and you can find the link there. Trust me, you want to add Athletic Greens to your day. It makes such a huge difference. Okay. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Functionally Autoimmune. We have a fantastic guest with us today. On the show, I have Dr. John. He is an amazing wealth of knowledge in the area of diabetics and insulin resistance, and he's going to share so much of that with us. So Dr. John has practiced as a pediatrician and allergist for about 30 years, and then he kind of shifted gears on studying diabetics and helping people to kind of manage their health field, and you know, but you were a myth buster and you provided science-based information and you did all these wonderful studies and things like that. But you also wrote about 5 books on these subjects as well, with your newest one being Your Health is at Risk. And so, Dr. John, welcome so much. And can you tell us how you kind of shifted gears and got into studying diabetics and those things?
Brandy, I thank you for having me and I thank our listeners.
Absolutely.
I was always curious about science in general and health sciences in particular. When I was a pediatric resident, I got interested in the subject of allergy and immunology, because that's one of the basic fundamental responses of the body.
Yeah.
And I was practicing, I board certified in pediatrics, board certified in allergy and immunology. During my private practice, I treated both adults and children. One day, I had a patient who was in the mid-40s, and he came for a follow-up of our allergy treatment program. But usually he's a very jovial, very funny guy. We talk and we laugh. But on that particular day, he was very sad. I didn't understand. So I asked him, you know, what's happening? What's wrong? And he waited a few seconds. He looked at me and said, "Doc, while we are talking, my mind is with my secretary. She's having her leg amputated right now." So I could see his pain, his discomfort, his concern. And so I asked him, "Oh, was she in an accident?" He said, "No." So I wondered why, you know, what's going on? Then he said, "You see, Doc, she's a diabetic. She has been taking insulin for the last few years, but she's having amputation of her leg as we speak." So I thought, well, that is not good. And I can see his concern, but somehow I felt there is more to the story than this, because the way he reacted, his distress was more than what he would feel for a colleague, even if his secretary.
Yeah.
So I waited, and he waited a couple of minutes and then started saying, "Doc, perhaps, you know, maybe you don't remember when I first came here, I told you, asked me the medications. I told him, I told you I am on some medications, but what I didn't tell you was I have been taking medications to control my own diabetes for the last few years." Okay, so I waited. And then he said, "Last week, my doctor told me I have to start taking insulin." And you see, Doc, my secretary took insulin. She kept her A1C below 7 for all these years. That did not stop her from having a leg amputation.
Yeah.
"Doc, I cannot afford to have my legs amputated. Mm-hmm. I run a business. I have 2 boys in high school. How am I going to take care of them if I cannot walk?" So that got me thinking, there is something wrong here. If you are resistant to an antibiotic, the doctor will not give you that antibiotic, right?
Right.
You will change to something else. But you are told you are a type 2 diabetic because your body is resisting insulin. And what does the doctor give you?
Right. Insulin.
How does that make sense? If you give somebody insulin, yes, her blood sugar goes down. Where does that sugar go?
That's a great question.
It does not go out of the body. Mm-hmm. So what good is it?
Yeah.
So these are the questions that I had that prompted me to look into this thing called insulin resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we hear that term a lot these days, insulin resistance. And I've seen a lot of talks and webinars on how to manage your insulin resistance and things like that. Can you give us your perspective on what does insulin resistance mean?
Let's go back and start what is diabetes?
Yeah.
Diabetes is a condition where your blood glucose level goes up, mm-hmm. right? That's the only test. The only test is blood glucose level.
Yeah.
And there are two types of, it is divided into two, type 1 and type 2. Mm-hmm. To understand the difference, you need to know the role of insulin. Insulin is a hormone, as you know, released from our pancreas in response to elevation of blood glucose level after a meal. Mm-hmm. So the first question is, how does insulin work?
Yeah.
Insulin does not get into a cell. Keep in mind, every cell can use glucose to produce energy, mm-hmm. but the glucose has to get inside the cell. When glucose is outside the cell, the glucose has no way of letting the cell know I'm outside.
Yeah.
If somebody rings your doorbell, you know there is somebody outside the door, whether you live in an apartment or a house, whatever.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
You have the option of going and opening the door or not.
Yeah.
When glucose is outside the cell has no way of knowing it. Mm-hmm. That is the job of insulin. Insulin is a messenger. It does not get into the cell. It is the one that rings the doorbell. Mm-hmm. Then the cell has to send a wagon, a transporter, open the door, load up the glucose, and then bring it in. Mm-hmm. Imagine in a child whose pancreas does not produce insulin. There are plenty of glucose in the blood, but the cells are starving.
Right.
Because they don't know glucose is outside. There's nobody to tell them.
Yeah.
And these children used to die by age 10 until insulin was discovered exactly 100 years ago. Mm. And then the lifespan of these children became normal. Their quality of life improved. They're just like everybody else.
Right.
Now, around that time, the doctor said, well, maybe it is the same thing is happening at an older age group in adults with high blood sugar. But something funny happened. That is, when a test became available, they found these adults with type 2 diabetes has normal or sometimes even more than or elevated levels of insulin in their blood.
Yeah.
So it didn't make sense. On the one hand, you have high insulin and high glucose at the same time.
Yeah.
So they had to come up with an explanation. So what happened was, around that time, there were the first reports of penicillin-resistant bacteria was published. So one endocrinologist, a couple of them thought, well, this is the same thing happening in the body.
Right.
So they transposed this theory of resistance onto the blood sugar in adults with type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
So that is how it was born.
Yeah.
Ordinarily, what happens is, if you have a hypothesis, a scientific hypothesis in any branch of science,
yeah, Yeah.
First, you have to say, does that make sense? There has to be a logic.
Right.
Second, what is the mechanism? If this is what you think is happening, how does it happen? You have to explain it.
Right.
Third, you have to have a measurement. What is the degree of resistance?
Right.
And if we can show the degree, then there's a measurement that independently somebody else can verify it. Then the hypothesis is accepted as a fact.
Right.
But in this case, none of that happened.
Right.
If you want me to elaborate on each one of them.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in, you know, if you have a person who has high glucose and high insulin, then the glucose should be able to get into the cells. So if that's where the insulin resistant idea came from, what are they actually suffering from? What's actually going on?
Well, that depends on, in order to understand that, you have to look at what does insulin, what does glucose do? Mm-hmm. And how does, in a child with type 1 diabetes, if you don't give insulin, that child is becoming weaker and weaker because the muscles cannot produce energy, the vital organs cannot function. And as I said, the child used to die before insulin was discovered. In adults, most of the time, if you are a pre-diabetic or a diabetic, you don't even know it unless you do a blood test.
Yeah.
There is no weakness of the muscle. You can run, you can dance, you can play, you can do professional sports. So the question is, what's the source of the energy? How can they function?
Right.
If they are insulin resistant, if they cannot use glucose to produce energy, what is the fuel and what is the manufacturing of energy? How does it happen?
Right.
Now, think about this. Suppose you could not eat all day today. Can you still get up and do your chores?
Yeah.
Why? Where does the energy come from?
Because it's stored. It's stored in your body, right?
Stored as what?
It's stored in your body as glycogen and then it uses glucose.
Just a second.
Okay.
The liver can store only 120 grams of glucose as glycogen, 120 grams. And the same amount in muscles.
Okay? Right. Yeah.
So that will not give you a whole lot of 120 grams. Each gram is 4 calories. Mm-hmm. And if you imagine, if you look at the total, you will not survive the whole day long.
Right.
Because what is in the liver is primarily reserved to supply glucose to brain cells.
Brain. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we have 120 grams at about 500, 600 calories stored in the muscle. And how long is that going to last? Depending on if you are completely resting and don't doing anything, that may work.
Right.
But if you're working, especially physical activity, that's not going to last very long.
Right. Right.
So where is the energy coming from?
So fat cells.
Yes, exactly. So you see, what happens is after a meal, can I ask you what you ate last night?
Last night I had a steak taco.
Steak taco. Okay, very good. What time did you eat?
It was about 6:30.
By about 10:30, the taco part has been digested and absorbed as glucose.
Right.
Because it's made of grain, right?
Yeah.
The meat part has been digested and absorbed as cholesterol and fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
And some fat.
Yeah.
That is fatty acids and cholesterol. So there is, and then any protein in the meat will be digested and absorbed as amino acids.
Right.
So for 10:30, if you take your blood, you will see in elevated levels of glucose, amino acids, fatty acids, and cholesterol.
Right.
The elevation of glucose will stimulate your pancreas to release insulin. That insulin goes with these nutrients all over the body through circulation 30 trillion cells. And it is insulin, as we mentioned, knocks on the door or rings the door and say, okay, we are outside.
Right.
And each cell picks up what it needs.
Mm-hmm.
Because bone cells need something different from red cells or from muscle cells, from liver cells. So each cell picks up only the nutrient they need.
Right.
The leftover will come back to the liver. The liver has, it can store only 120 grams of glucose as glycogen.
Right.
The rest will be converted into long-term storage, which is fat.
Right.
So from glucose to acetyl coenzyme A to fatty acid to fat. Cholesterol will be cleaned up and put back into the bloodstream as cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
And now there is LDL and HDL. We can talk about it a little later if you want to know about it. And what's the difference and which one is actually good?
Yeah.
or my question usually is, HDL is considered good cholesterol. Why? What good does it do?
Well, that's a great question.
Right. You can ask me that later.
Okay.
So whatever excess of glucose, amino acids, fatty acid, they are all converted into fat called triglyceride. That is three molecules of fatty acid combined with one molecule of glycerol, and that is sent to the storage area, the fat cell. Each one of us inherit a finite number of fat storage capacity in terms of fat cell, the size of the fat cell. So depending on our inheritance, some may have 10-pound fat storage capacity, some may have 200 fat storage capacity.
Yeah.
It's just like a refrigerator, what cubic feet?
Yeah.
The size is, if you buy more groceries than what you can store, the grocery has to stay outside.
Yeah.
So as we eat, any excess is converted into fat, triglyceride, sent to the fat cell, it is stored.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine for a minute that your fat cells are completely full.
Okay.
What will happen to the fatty acid? The liver will not convert that fatty acid to fat because there's no place to store it. The fatty acid will stay in the blood.
Okay.
The fatty acid can be used as fuel for muscles to generate energy.
Yeah.
Similar to a hybrid engine in a car.
Right.
The car can run on electricity or gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
If the car is running on gasoline, is it resistant to electricity?
No.
No, exactly. That is what is happening in a type 2 diabetic. When muscles are generating energy from fatty acid, does it need glucose?
Right.
And if it doesn't need it, why should it let it in?
Yeah, that's a great point.
So it accumulates, the glucose accumulates in the blood simply because the muscles don't need it now.
Right.
So if you lose the fat, if you lose weight, then there is no excess fatty acid. The muscles go back using glucose.
Right.
So did I use the term insulin resistance anywhere here?
No.
No. So this is what is going on. Insulin resistance is a concept that has never been validated through the usual scientific validation process of logic. For example, there are 200 types of cell in the body. You know how many are supposed to be resistant to insulin?
How many?
Three.
Okay.
The liver, the fat, and muscle.
Yeah.
Now, suppose you are living in a 200 unit apartment complex.
Mm-hmm.
Three people at three different levels, unknown to each other, decide one day, from tomorrow, we are not going to respond to the UPS driver.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
No.
That is what is happening. What is the endocrinologists are telling us? That three cells in three different organs decided one day, we will resist insulin.
Right.
That makes no sense.
Yeah.
And there is no mechanism. Is it because the doorbell is not ringing? Is it something wrong? Or right. something wrong with the connection? The transmission is not there? Or is it the gene in charge of sending the glucose transporter not working? Is it the same defect in all these three sites? Nobody knows.
Right.
And right. is there a measurement? Is there a test to measure the degree of insulin resistance?
No.
No. Whether you have had it 20 years, whether you have leg amputated, how do you know? Is it because your insulin resistance is getting worse?
Right.
And if you give somebody insulin, blood glucose level goes down. Does that mean your resistance is lower?
No.
Without a test, how do you know?
Right. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting information. I never thought of it that way, but that it makes a lot of sense.
We are not asked to think. We are not asked to ask questions. The best example is I've talked to many certified diabetic educators. And they are not asked to question the endocrinologist. They are only asked to propagate right. the norm or the message. Yeah. So the whole concept of type 2 diabetes treatment is based on belief system,
mm-hmm.
not science.
Yeah.
That's my problem.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you. And I was reading through some of your literature and you mentioned reversing type 2 diabetes. So, and I completely agree that it's reversible because I believe that there are many autoimmune conditions that are reversible. So how would someone go about knowing if they can reverse their type 2 diabetes or what can they do? How does that work?
Let us look at what is called a temporary type 2 diabetes condition.
Okay.
Here, what I'm referring to is called gestational diabetes.
Yeah.
Okay. A young woman with no family history of diabetes, no previous history of diabetes, at the end of second trimester is diagnosed with gestational diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanism is supposed to be exactly the same as in type 2 diabetes. She develops insulin resistance.
Yeah.
Now, let me take it from my perspective. What I just described as fatty acid burn switch.
Yeah.
Instead of burning glucose, the muscles are burning fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
The moment that young woman is pregnant, everybody's excited. She's yeah. excited. Her friends are excited. And family is excited. Then now they will start telling her, oh, you should eat this. This is good for the baby's brain. This is good for the baby's complexion. This uh-huh. is good for the baby's bone. This is good for the baby's muscle. Oh, this will make you the baby smarter. And yeah. she eats. And pretty soon her fat storage capacity is filled up.
Mm-hmm.
She gained 20, 30 pounds.
Right.
There's no more place to store the fat. And the fatty acid stays in the blood. Her muscles start using fatty acid. Then glucose starts going up. Nobody's using the glucose. And she's diagnosed as a gestational diabetic.
Right.
3 days, 4 days after delivery, she loses weight. She's not feeling very well. She's not eating very well. She drains some of the fat cells out. The fat goes back into the fat cell. The body starts using glucose again. Her blood sugar is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
That's
yeah.
the best yeah. example I can give you that
yeah.
explains what I'm saying. Now, to make it interesting, let me tell you this. These people are supposed to be at a higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes later in life,
mm-hmm.
right? You heard that?
Yeah.
Why? If you look at what stage of their life, regardless of age,
mm-hmm.
when they develop type 2 diabetes, you know what you will see? They gain the same amount of weight as they did when they were pregnant.
Wow, yeah.
You see the correlation there?
Yeah.
That amount of weight they gained filled up their fat storage capacity. So it has nothing to do with the pregnancy.
Right.
It is more to do with the weight gain.
Right. Yeah. Pregnant
or not, if you gain the weight to fill up your fat storage capacity, that is when you become type 2 diabetic.
Right.
So to reverse it is very simple. Don't take any excess. that your body cannot use before your next meal.
Right.
Energy containing nutrients, because the body will store it as fat. That's all you have to think about.
Right.
So in the modern day, what percentage of energy is coming from what nutrient? There are only three major nutrients that carry energy. Mm-hmm. I divide the nutrients into essential nutrients and energy nutrients. Mm-hmm. Among the energy nutrients are the usual carbohydrate, protein, and fat.
Right.
100 years ago, we didn't have this diabetic epidemic. The percentage of food energy, daily food energy, that came from complex carbohydrate was 35%. You know how much it is now? In the developed countries, it is 50%. In developing countries, it is 70%.
Wow.
Because of grains.
Yeah.
When is the last time you had a meal or a snack without a grain product?
Well, I'm celiac, so I try and avoid it as much as possible. But
you try to avoid the wheat.
Yes.
But still,
other grains. But the average person, I think every meal that they eat has some sort of grain in it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You are lucky, and I should not say lucky, but in a way, because of your condition, you have gone into that deeper, and that is what I like about, that is what we have in common.
Yeah.
You have a reason, but you are just not happy with what you got, what you want to know on your own. Does it make sense?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, and I agree. I think with processed food and just the increase of people eating grains and wheat and flours and breads, it seems to be that's what people eat more than fruits and vegetables or even meats.
Well, we cannot blame the people because that is the cheapest food available.
Mm-hmm. That's
the most convenient food available.
Yeah.
And what is sad is young mothers giving their children, I saw the other day, we were at a restaurant and the mother was bringing in very thick crust pizzas for twins sitting there and eating. Mm-hmm. Why the thick crust? Because that will fill them up faster.
Yeah.
She does not have to spend a whole lot of money to make these children feel full.
Yeah.
The stomach fullness has become more important than the nutrient content of the meal.
Right.
And if that children grow up, you can see what's going to happen. They will rely on fullness of the stomach, and that can be accomplished faster by grain-based foods because they absorb water and give you the feeling of fullness.
Yeah.
Now, consider this. When you drink water, when you're thirsty, let's say you're thirsty, can you predict the amount of water that will take to quench your thirst?
No.
How long will it take you to drink? Suppose I bring you water right now.
Yeah.
How much will you drink?
Maybe eight ounces or so.
No. If you are
really thirsty,
just right now, how much will it take to quench your thirst? How many sips?
maybe three or four.
Three or four sips. Mm-hmm. In other words, you cannot predict.
Yeah.
And when you drink it, that does not fill up your stomach.
Right.
So yet your thirst is quenched by the time you're done.
Uh-huh.
How did the brain know you drank enough water to quench your thirst?
Oh. Yeah. It just knew.
Just knew.
Yeah.
But not from the fullness of the stomach.
Right.
Okay, so shall I go on?
Yes, please.
If I blindfold you, if I give you something to drink, mm-hmm. you will know immediately whether it is milk or water or beer or coffee. How do you know?
You know the taste because you've tasted before.
Correct.
Yeah.
What I'm suggesting is those taste buds are telling the brain not only what is the nature, but also they are measuring how much is going down.
Mm-hmm.
And the brain already knows your water deficit. If you have had a workout, you have been in a hot day, you need more.
Yeah.
But if you're just sitting and talking, just chatting like this, you need only a few sips.
Yeah.
And the brain, when the water, that amount of water has gone through your mouth, the brain says, okay, this is enough.
Right.
You feel satisfied. You don't feel full. That's the difference.
Yeah.
If you pay attention, if you are hungry, the first bite of food tastes so good.
Yeah.
As you eat, after a few minutes, it doesn't taste as good.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who practiced this the best?
Who?
Toddlers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody from you up to 6 years of age, if you look at them, how they eat, you will observe three things. One, they will not eat unless they are hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Not like adults. Oh, today somebody's birthday. Oh, I bought special. Second, if you give the toddlers 10 items, they will pick and choose.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most number one complaint for a young mother to the pediatrician, by a young mother to the pediatrician, is my child is not eating if it's a toddler.
Yeah.
Yesterday he ate so well. I made the same food, but today he didn't even touch it.
Mm-hmm.
The child will decide what to eat, when to eat, and when the child is done, the child could care less how much is left on the plate.
Yeah.
The child will go out and play. What about adults? Oh, I cannot waste the food because there are starving people in India and China.
Right.
I would rather put it on my waist rather than put it in my waste basket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true.
So this is what is going on. We are not eating for nutrition and satisfaction. We are eating for fullness.
Yeah.
And that fullness comes easily with grain-based foods.
Mm-hmm.
And grain-based foods are cheaper because every government, almost every government in the world, is subsidizing grain farming.
Yeah.
Or grain flour usage, or through ration cards, or food subsidies, agricultural subsidies, fertilizer subsidies, you name it.
Yeah.
Cheap food available are all made with grains. And the most convenient foods are all made with, most of them are made with grains.
Right, right, wow. So would your advice be to avoid grains completely? Or if you had someone come in that was newly diagnosed, what would be your kind of first step or your first suggestion for them?
Look back, let me give you this story. When Native Americans were brought to the reservation in the year 1900, they had complete physical examination. You know, doctors were curious, what is their status?
Yeah.
And you know, two things they could not find very many in among the Native Americans, type 2 diabetes and cancer. Okay.
Yeah.
Very practically no type 2 diabetes, no cancer. Now, if you look at the Pima Indians in Arizona, above age 35, 50% of them are type 2 diabetic.
Yeah.
50%. So what happened? Imagine the Native Americans, the way they lived. They moved from one food source to another.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
They did not stay in one place. So they did not eat cultivated grains.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, but they did eat complex carbohydrate like tubers and other things.
Yeah.
Percentage of energy, food energy, daily food energy from complex carbohydrate was less than about 30-35%.
Yeah.
So yes, you can have grains, but if you go back to the way we were doing before 100 years ago, the easiest way will be to cut down the amount of grain-based complex carbohydrate foods to one half of what you are eating right now. If you're eating 2 pieces of bread, eat one.
Yeah.
If you eat so much pasta, eat half of that.
Right.
So I'm not suggesting you should not eat. The quantity is the part.
Mm-hmm.
Just do half of what you are eating in terms of complex carbohydrate, you'll be fine.
And that seems pretty doable and easy to do, right?
Well, you may think that. the first question when I say to you, people ask me is, so what else can I eat?
Yeah.
So they're not thinking, they're still waiting on the fullness of the stomach. How can I fill up my stomach?
Right.
So how you eat, my first book was called Eat, Chew, Live. And on the top here, there's a line, banner line, how you eat matters more than what you eat.
Yeah.
So if you don't take time to chew, most of the foods that we are eating now, how much can you chew rice? How much can you chew bread? How much can you chew pasta, noodles, cakes, cupcakes? If you stop chewing, you swallow.
Yeah.
So that increases the quantity without increasing or enhancing the taste, because in order to enjoy, it has to come in contact with your taste buds or your smell receptors.
Mm-hmm.
So if you pour water or if you pour wine straight into your throat, how much can you enjoy?
Oh, not much.
Right. You have to sip it.
Yeah.
You have to connect it. So that is what is happening. You are consuming so much more food that you cannot enjoy. You are not enjoying it.
Right.
And that is what the toddlers do. They take their time, they chew it, they enjoy it. The first bite is so good, but when the enjoyment goes down, they stop eating.
Yeah.
So if you do that, then you know the weight loss will be gradual.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, when you gain weight, you don't gain 100 pounds a month. You do 1 or 2 pounds a year. You add on, add on, add on.
Yeah.
So if you lose the weight at that rate, it helps your physiological systems in the body to adjust.
Right.
What you need is a variety, because human body needs 100 different nutrients. And you cannot get all of them from one food group or one meal.
Right.
If you provide variety, you sit down in a place, when you have food in your mouth, concentrate on the enjoyment. Don't be distracted by TV or any other visual communications, because that will take precedence over taste buds.
Yeah.
If you're watching TV, an interesting program, half the food will be gone before you, what happened?
Yeah. That's true. That's very true. Yeah, for sure. I love every ounce of that, because it all really completely makes sense. And I think that it's things that we can easily do and incorporate, but it's things that we don't think about as being, you know, we're so used to our busy lives and watching TV or being on our phones or doing these things that there's a lot of mindless eating that happens. And I think that everyone's just kind of gotten accustomed to that, but it's a great point that we oftentimes overeat just because we're not paying attention to what we're eating or what we're doing.
Is there any other activity in life, day-to-day life, everyday life, that you can enjoy so many times a day, still get full enjoyment? I tell people, this may be a joke question, even sex you cannot have so 4 or 5 times a day and enjoy it to the maximum.
Yeah, right.
But eating is something you can enjoy every few hours, provided you are hungry.
Right.
So if you have that kind of enjoyment, why don't we use it?
Yeah.
That's all I'm asking. Enjoy. Eat what you enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all enjoy eating.
Yeah.
But are we really enjoying what we eat?
Right. Yeah. So that brings me to a question. Does it matter how often we eat? Or is it better to eat smaller meals, more times a day, 3 meals a day? Does any of that really matter?
Let me ask you a reverse question. Does it matter how many times you drink, or does it matter how much quantity you drink each time?
No.
No. That's the answer.
Okay.
If you respond to your body's own signals,
mm-hmm.
this is a very interesting question. It's a serious question, because I was discussing like this, and one of my colleagues said, John, I finished eating, but I'm still hungry. Why? If your theory is correct, why should I be hungry? I said, okay, what is the reason for hunger. You cannot predict when you're going to be hungry, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what is the physiological reason for the brain to create the sensation of hunger?
So nutrients, right?
Nutrients.
Yeah.
Yeah, you said plural. Whereas in case of water, there is only one. Mm-hmm. The brain knows when your water level in the body is low, it creates sensation of thirst.
Mm-hmm.
But a body needs 100 nutrients.
Yeah.
So, and every part of the body is sending messages to the control center in the brain. Okay, I'm low in vitamin. I'm low in mineral. I'm low in glucose. In, there are different messages coming in, and the control center has to tally them up.
Yeah.
And when it reaches a threshold level, it creates the sensation of hunger. So the component of that threshold level is variable from one hunger sensation to another.
Yeah.
The best example is if you bring your blood glucose level down with an insulin injection, you will feel hungry very fast.
Yeah.
Because your brain cells need glucose. They preferably use glucose as fuel.
Right.
So that, but even a diabetic feels hungry. If you have high blood sugar, you still feel hungry.
Right.
Why? Because your body needs some other nutrients.
Right.
The glucose is not a component of that hunger sensation. There are other nutrients. So depending on when you reach the threshold, depending on the variability of signals coming in, your generation of hunger, their feeling can be variable in terms of timing.
Yeah.
And each person is different. And
right.
The quantity you need to fill the need to replace the nutrient is different.
Right.
So when you sit down to eat, do you know what nutrient your body is missing?
No.
No. So that is why you cannot predict.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you start eating, you don't even know the food in front of you has the nutrients that your body needs at that time.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get hungry, you open the refrigerator, nothing looks appealing.
Right.
Why? Because your subconscious mind knows exactly what nutrients your body needs. What are the components of your hunger sensation?
Yeah.
And your subconscious mind also knows what foods provided the same nutrients in the past. And if they are not there in the refrigerator, it says, don't worry, that's not what I want.
Yeah.
But you're still hungry.
Right.
That is what happened to my colleague. I told him that what you ate did not contain the nutrients what your body needed at that time.
Right.
Now, she said, how do we know that happens? Now, can I tell you, can I give you my answer to that?
Yes, please.
Suppose we go for a buffet for lunch,
mm-hmm.
100 items. How many will you choose?
Maybe three or four.
Three or four, based on what?
What looks good or what I like to eat.
Based on your previous experience.
Yeah.
Okay, we sit down, we ate the four or five, and you enjoy them, okay?
Yeah.
Suppose we go back to the same buffet for supper. This is lunch, now supper. Yeah. Will you take exactly the same four or five?
Potentially.
You will take exactly the same, even though you had it for lunch. Will you eat the same for supper too?
I would probably change it up a bit, but probably a couple of them would be the same.
But some of them will be different.
Yeah.
Why?
Different tastes or different.
Why? Why do you feel that you have to have? Do you will enjoy the other two more this time?
I don't know. I think sometimes it's dinner, so you think you're supposed to eat certain foods.
There is a physiological reason for that thinking.
Yeah.
The nutrients you got from your lunch, they have not been used up.
Yeah.
But some other nutrients, the brain got reports from other areas of the body. We need this, this, and that. And based on your previous experience, your subconscious mind knows where can you get those nutrients, which foods will provide those nutrients. Though it will send a message to the conscious part of the brain, the other one looks more appealing now.
Yes.
And this one, don't worry about this one because you had it, you have enough.
Uh-huh.
So you change, you pick them without really thinking. You don't have to think. Your message is already there. So you pick something different.
Yeah.
Because they are more enjoyable. They are enjoyable because that's the way for your brain to reward you for picking what your body needs.
Yeah.
So you don't even know what your body is looking for. How can anybody give you a diet and tell you, okay, you eat only 3 meals a day, 5 meals a day,
yeah,
or so much, how many servings of carbohydrate, complex carbohydrate, meat? How can anybody give you that?
Right. They can't. Everyone's different.
Right. And every day is different.
Right.
Every meal is different.
Yeah.
And when you go and sit down, you don't know what is left in your body, how many nutrients are there, what is missing, what food it will come from. And nowadays, the food itself is modified so much. Do we have all the nutrients that we used to have in the same food before?
Right. No. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think too, that kind of points to how we've gotten to a point of overeating, because if the majority of our diet is grains or grain-like foods, then we're not, you know, that's the same kind of nutrients in those things, or lack of nutrients in those things, depending on what you're eating, that you're kind of eating multiple times. So your body feels like it's full more often, or hungry, not full, feels like it's hungry more often, right? Because it's still looking for those nutrients.
Both sentences are correct.
Yeah.
It is full because of the grain-based foods make you feel full physically.
Yeah.
But there is a condition newly diagnosed called obesity with malnutrition.
Mm-hmm.
You are obese because of the excess energy, but you are not getting the nutrients and you suffer from malnutrition.
Yeah.
And that has never happened in the history of humankind before.
There's
something new. And that's exactly what you are explaining. We eat and we are going into the fullness of the stomach as the limiting factor rather than drop in enjoyment.
Yeah.
So we need a new way of thinking about eating. We need a new way of eating by concentrating on the enjoyment part,
mm-hmm,
not the fullness part. The satisfaction,
right,
is more important, just like in the case when you drink water.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. This has been very eye-opening and I love it.
Thank you.
And I like your take on all of it. I think it's very eye-opening. And again, like I said before, you hear insulin resistance so much, but you don't ever really understand, or it's never explained to you what exactly it is or what it means to be insulin resistant. So your explanation of that makes so much more sense than just assuming that our bodies just can't use insulin.
So, you know, it does not make any sense. There are three types of cells becoming resistant. Ordinarily, if you have an autoimmune disease, there is a reason.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being your immune cells are attacking your own body cells.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the question is, why? We can go even, we are going into a different subject, but still it is interesting because of your interest in it. May I explain a little bit more
on
that?
Yes, please.
The question is, what does the immune system do? What is the primary function of the immune system? The immune system is there to protect the body from something the body does not need or like or injurious to the body.
Yeah.
The two major examples are infections and cancer. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we have an infectious agent in the body, the immune system has to recognize this is an infectious agent.
Yeah.
not a normal component of the body.
Right.
How does the immune system recognize that? Because of the proteins, there are certain proteins as labels on the infectious agent or the germ, let's say germ.
Yeah.
There is a protein that the body recognizes as foreign or an agent.
Yeah.
In order to do that, think about this. The immune system cells need to know what is normal.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
If you don't know what is normal, how can you identify the abnormal?
Right.
Because if the immune system cannot recognize the normal, it will attack the normal.
Yeah.
And you call it what?
Autoimmune disease.
Right. So the problem in autoimmune disease is the instruction the immune cells received, there is a flaw. It did not learn to recognize this component in the cell. In autoimmune disease, whether it is a cartilage or stomach or whatever, there is every cell in the body. We have 30 trillion cells, 200 different types. There's a badge which identifies the cell as normal. If that badge is there, the immune cell says, leave it alone. That's part of our normal cell.
Yeah.
If that badge, if the immune cells have not been taught to recognize those badges, it will attack. It thinks it is a protein, it is a foreign agent to be destroyed.
Yeah.
How does the immune cells know? Where do they go to school to learn that?
That's a great question. Where do they go to school?
Their schooling takes place in the gut. Mm-hmm. In your intestine, the large intestine, there are 120 varieties of germs who are normal residents, the beneficial bacteria. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Newly minted immune cells coming out of the, graduating from the school or college, they go to the gut to learn who are the normal. How can the body tolerate this number or variety of germs? Because they carry the same badge as cells in the normal body.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So they are tolerated because the body thinks they're part of, there's another organ here.
Yeah.
It's part of body cells.
Right.
So what's the better place for the immune system cells to go? Newly minted young graduates of immune college go there and learn how to recognize normal cells.
Yeah.
So they go to the gut, they learn, okay, if anybody has these badges, they are normal. Leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose the badge representing a protein naturally in the body is missing. Suppose that bacteria is not represented in the gut.
Yeah.
Will the immune system get the training?
No.
That is what happens in autoimmune disease.
Yeah.
I think, it's my personal opinion, it starts in the gut.
Yeah.
The gut flora. Now the question is, what is the methodology by which the normal gut flora is established? Do you know those who are babies who are breastfed, they're less likely to develop type 1 diabetes?
Wow. Yeah.
Especially if those who are given wheat-based products, gliadin and gluten, early in their infancy, they have a higher chance of developing type 1 diabetes unless the babies are also breastfed.
Right.
So what is the importance of breastfeeding?
Nutrients.
what nutrients in specific?
Well, you're getting all of the bacteria and all the nutrients from the mom.
No, you don't get bacteria from the mom. The breast milk is sterile. Okay. What you are getting is a group of complex carbohydrates called oligosaccharides.
Mm-hmm.
the oligosaccharides will not be digested by human intestinal digestive enzymes.
Yeah.
They feed the bacteria in the colon. So they provide food for the normal beneficial bacteria in the colon, and they are needed to train the immune cells.
Yeah.
So the best way to protect your child from autoimmune disease is breastfeed the child.
Right.
I don't think we have any other known way of preventing autoimmune disease. And secondly, to delay the introduction of wheat-based products, gliadin and gluten-containing food products that you are very well aware of.
Yeah.
Into the, or you don't need them.
Right.
Grains were never meant for humans. Otherwise, we would have had beaks to pick them up.
Yeah, I agree.
And the ability to digest the chaff.
Right.
We don't.
Yeah, absolutely so agree.
You are not going to miss any nutrients you don't need. So there's a whole myth about whole grain versus refined grain.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Why is whole grain so great?
Because someone says it is.
It still contains the same amount of carbohydrate.
Right.
That part is they don't say it. Mm-hmm. And it is just the brand then. If the brand is important, you can have the brand by itself.
Right.
Or you may have the same nutrients in coverings of other seeds and nuts.
Yeah.
Why does it have to be grain?
Right. Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree.
Okay. We have a couple more minutes. There's a subject I thought you were going to raise. Do you have time?
Yes, I think that we have a couple minutes. I do also want to make sure that we have time for you to tell everybody where they can find your books and where they can find you. So if you want to go ahead and share that information so we make sure to get that in, you can definitely do that.
I have a website called drjohnonhealth.com, and all my books are available on Amazon.
Okay. Doctor, and I will definitely make sure to put that in the show notes as well so that you guys have easy access to that. And then I think the other question, Dr. John, that I was going to ask is we had kind of a brief conversation in the beginning about HDLs and LDLs. And so we would touch on that.
That's the one that I'm trying to remind you.
Yeah.
So tell me, why is HDL called good cholesterol? What good does it do?
So you're putting me on the spot. So the good cholesterol helps to kind of keep things moving and is, I can't think of the words I'm trying to say.
when we were in medical school, we were told, we were taught, good cholesterol will pick up bad cholesterol from the arterial wall and bring it back to the liver.
Right.
Okay. Imagine you have a stick-on label, stick-on paper. And that represents, the first one represents bad cholesterol. Mm-hmm. You put it on the tabletop. It is sticking there.
Yeah.
Okay. You bring another stick on that represents the HDL and stick it on top of the first one.
Uh-huh.
Can the second one remove the first by itself?
By itself, no.
No. Because HDL, LDL, they are just molecules.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot produce energy.
Yeah.
So HDL cannot pull the LDL off the table or off the arterial wall. That's not going to happen.
Right.
So what is HDL good for?
That's a great question because I believed what you just described.
Right. You know why it is called good cholesterol?
Why?
Because it does not do any harm.
Okay.
So are you a good person if you don't do anything? Or do you have to do something good to be called a good person?
I guess if you don't do anything bad, you can be called a good person.
That is the definition.
Yeah.
What do you call a person who does some good?
A really good person.
A really good person. So that's my problem. Why is it called a good cholesterol?
Right.
You know why it doesn't do any harm? Well, let me go back and say, what is cholesterol used for in the body? What's the use of cholesterol? Do you know?
Yeah. I think I know.
People know, you know, that cholesterol is used for producing some hormones in the body.
Uh-huh.
But that is not the major use of cholesterol.
Right.
The cholesterol is an integral component of the cell wall. It is an insulator.
Right.
If you don't have cholesterol and fatty acids in the cell wall,
mm-hmm.
you will become dehydrated on a hot day, just like a plant will do in the sunlight.
Yeah.
And you will get frostbitten in a cold day because you will lose heat.
Right.
So that is the most important use of... Sorry about that. So that is the most important use of cholesterol as an insulator.
Right.
And in order for the cell to incorporate the cholesterol molecule sticks to the outside cell wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cell picks up inside.
Right.
And sticky cholesterol is the LDL. The body uses the LDL for all its construction.
Yeah.
And if there is excess, the liver puts a protein cap on the cholesterol molecule.
Yeah.
That protein cap prevents it from sticking. And that protein cap gives more density to the cholesterol molecule, then becomes high density cholesterol.
Right.
The HDL is made of normal cholesterol with the protein cap. That means it cannot stick anywhere, cannot do any harm.
Right.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
So even if you elevate your HDL, it is not going to do you any good.
Right.
What is important is to keep your LDL down regardless of your HDL.
Right. Right. So LDL is really the most important thing. So when you're going and have your lab work and things done, you really just want to pay attention to your LDL.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And, you know,
Don't waste money, time, and energy on boosting your HDL level. It is not going to do any good, as far as I'm concerned.
So when there's products out there or food products that say, this will boost your good cholesterol or this is good for your cholesterol, it really doesn't do anything.
As far as I can see, unless somebody can show me evidence. We have never seen in the blood a molecule where HDL and LDL are combined. If the HDL is removing LDL, you should have a molecule, a double molecule, right?
Right, yeah.
Has anybody described that?
Not that I've seen.
I have not seen either.
But yeah, that's really interesting because that's what I totally have always believed is that it just kind of keeps things flowing and it cleans up the area and you know, it grabs that bad LDL and moves it out and it keeps you from getting blocked arteries and, you know, all those things.
Yeah, that is how the practitioners have been taught. That is how we have been taught in the medical school. And you have been told the same thing.
Yeah.
And so in nutshell, everybody has to take responsibility for his or her own health and start asking questions just like you did, just like I did.
Yeah.
You know, does it make sense? Mm-hmm. If it doesn't make sense, get the information. Then decide for yourself what you need to do to protect your body.
Right. Yeah, I love that. Well, we are out of time, but thank you so much, Dr. John, for all of your information and all this. It was such a great conversation and so much great information. And I thank you so much for that.
I thank you for spreading the information because there are many people out there who don't even have the basic information.
Yeah.
This is the problem we are going to face. There's a big gap between scientific advances and common knowledge.
Yeah.
And that gap is getting filled with misinformation, disinformation, and missing information.
Yeah.
And that is the topic of my book, Why Your Health is at Risk Because of All These Information Chaos.
I love that. And that's your newest book. And again, we can find that on Amazon or your website, correct?
Correct.
Yes. Yes.
Just late last week.
Oh, last week. That's great.
Yeah.
So hot off the press.
Yeah, it is.
I love that. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. John. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And we will catch you on the next episode.
Thank you.